It's been a long week. We have talked about LGBT rights in Georgia, how to teach kids to manage their money. And as we do every Friday, it's time to gather a group of smart people to help us kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened this week. It is time for The Break Room.
I do this because I believe the truth is powerful, and it takes constant vigilance to drown out that truth with noise.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
Joining us in the break room this week, Sam Burnham curates the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. Tamika DePriest is Senior Director of Communications at Emory University. Julianne Thompson is a Republican strategist and former press secretary for the Georgia GOP. And Kathy Lohr, former NPR correspondent and frequent guest. Welcome, everybody. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
Hi.
Good morning.
Friday.
All right. So let's remember the Super Bowl. Remember how that happened just last weekend. Some may still be mourning the Atlanta Falcons' tragic Super Bowl loss.
Yes.
How many of us at the table?
Yes.
Still mourning that?
Very much.
Yes.
Sam Burnham shrugging.
I'm a Buccaneers fan.
Oh, boy. Okay, we're going to get complaints. Others are still thinking about the halftime show.
This land was made for you and me.
One nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
That was the voice of Lady Gaga. After that performance, there was some disagreement on social media about whether or not the performance was political. Some say she completely avoided making any political statements. Others say they were clear but subtle messages. So what do we think? Was it a political performance or not?
Yes.
It was political.
It was quietly political. I mean, her songs are political by nature. Born This Way, This Land, actually, Listen was your line. I didn't know the history of that until I looked it up about how it was kind
Woody
of
Guthrie,
a protest song even then about everyone being equal. So I think she did a fantastic job.
I agree with Kathy in this instance. I think about sort of just where we are as a nation, the divisiveness and the conversations that have been happening. I think she was very intentional in how she put together her performance and opening with God Bless America. And so in this instance, I think the personal is political.
Jan?
You know, she may have been slightly political, but I don't know anybody that had any objections to the way that she did that. It was beautiful. It was a beautiful performance, a classic American song. Whether or not her intentions were slightly political is completely irrelevant to me. I thought she was very respectful, and I enjoyed it.
And I think Kathy makes a very good point that a lot of her material is political in nature anyway. She doesn't have to make it political. I really didn't see a lot of politics in it as far as overt. I think she covered all the bases. I like she starts out, she says, hey, we're here to make you feel good, come feel good with us. And it was more of a both sides of the aisle, this is the Super Bowl, it's halftime, let's have fun.
So the lyrics to Born This Way, if you haven't read them, that is was when it was written a fairly political song. Robbie Medwed tweets, so does this mean that saying all LGBT people should be accepted for who they are is not political anymore? Yay. if you have any responses to anything that we're talking about, you know how to reach us. You can tweet us at OST Talk or find us on Facebook. There was another controversial Super Bowl performance. The stars of Hamilton, Renee Goldsberry, Jasmine Jones, and Philippa Sue sang a rendition of America the Beautiful. They added one little thing, though.
And crown thy good with
brotherhood and
sisterhood.
So they added the words and sisterhood. They received some pretty sharp criticism for doing that. But I wondered, this is not the national anthem, right? Like, why are we not allowed to change the lyrics of America the Beautiful? Is this a sacred song to us?
We changed the lyrics of other songs. I mean, I sort of didn't get it either, and I thought it went right with sort of, you know, who they are and what they represented in terms of their roles in Hamilton. And so, again, the personal was political. And I don't mean that in a bad sense, although I know when we use the term political now, we often think of the bad sense.
Because politics are a bummer.
But I think of it in terms of making a statement.
I think with all the problems we have going on in the world, if what we have time for is to criticize adding sisterhood to a song, we are greatly off target.
She and, has got her priorities straight.
I thought it was beautiful. I had no problem with it.
Yeah, it was sung beautifully. It was nice to hear some great singers.
It was beautiful. And my favorite part was they showed Falcons coach Dan Reeves smiling when they said that. So that was just a moment.
I think he was smiling because he still thought he was going to win the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
That was we all may have thought that in Atlanta.
Yeah, we did think so.
I'm Jeffersonian. I'm also the only guy in the room and sitting next to the door so I can get out of here quickly. But the brotherhood, looking at the language, looking at the definition behind the word, I don't know that it's – today we see that as a gendered term. I don't know that it necessarily is.
Oh, I think I do as a female.
That's why I'm sitting next to the exit door in case I need to get out of here. But I like to think that the word brotherhood in that song includes us all.
I bet you would like to think that. No, I'm kidding. I'm giving you trouble. He mentioned Jeffersonian because Jefferson was famously not a huge fan of Hamilton. It's fair enough. I mean, you know, it's like the people who feel like mankind is not gender specific.
Right.
Right? That's right. What the sense
of it. I think that's what we're saying. I think that includes all of us. And, you know, the dictionary term says that, but...
Dream on.
Yeah.
To be fair, Sam is the only male in the room.
No, and I agree with Sam. I agree with Sam. I don't think that it's meant to be gender specific, but I think that, you know, on one side of the aisle you have some people that have a problem with the word brotherhood, and then on the other side you have a problem with the fact that they added sisterhood. I don't think either one of them are any big deal at all, and we need to get our priorities straight.
Fair enough. All right. Speaking of priorities, sometimes I don't do important things so I could just listen to music. A recent study published in the journal Scientific Reports finds that listening to music actually activates the exact same neurological pleasure center in your brain as sex and drugs.
Oh, isn't that cute? My little Stewie likes Anne Murray.
She sounds like an angel. It's like her voice is putting my entire body in her mouth.
Okay, according to the study, pleasure is experienced in two phases while listening to the music. The first is the wanting phase, driven by dopamine. The second phase is the liking phase that's fueled by something similar to the opioid effect in the brain. So when they intentionally blocked that part of the brain and people listened to music, they felt no emotional response to the music whatsoever. So here's the question. Should we consider music to be addictive?
I think it is. I really do. I know, especially, and that's not based on any scientific facts, just on the people that I know that love to listen to music and will sit in their car and play it really loudly and find other things to do.
Is it you? Are you the one that sits in your car and plays it really loud?
My husband and myself, too. Yeah.
What is he listening to?
Rock and roll.
Oh, come on. Sam?
You can't find a religion, a culture, any group that isn't attached to the music that goes with that. It plays such a vital role in everything we do. It's so emotionally connected to us. I think it's definitely addictive. This study doesn't surprise me at all.
What music are you addicted to?
I really like a lot of different kinds. I like, you know, classical music. I like rock music. I like folk music. I like different types of world music. I'm not real picky with music because I really enjoy it.
I'm struggling with this one because I am a huge music fan, but I haven't found myself unable to separate from earbuds on most occasions. I haven't found myself spending more than my budget on music downloads or feeling anxiety when my iPhone or iPod is not close by. I'm not sure, but too much of anything can be addictive, but I'm not sure about this one.
Well, let me put it to you this way. Have you never, like, had a song that you just wanted to listen to over and over, even though it was a bad song?
I have, but when I've gotten out of, I might have hit rewind two or three times in the car, but once I'm out of the car, I'm not thinking about it and I'm not jonesing for it.
Julianne?
I do think it's addictive. In a positive and can be in a negative way. I mean, of course, when I go to work out, I want certain types of music to inspire me, to get me going.
Pump you up.
And it's also a proven fact that if students listen to Mozart and various types of classical music before taking the SAT on a regular basis for about 3 weeks, it has a positive effect on how they do with regard to testing. So music definitely operates different, turns on different parts of your brain. What? So
see, that's the second part of that question.
Change your mood.
That's the second part of the question. We got a tweet from Adam Dean who says, if music is an addiction, I'm definitely a junkie. I guess some addictions are healthy. So that's the other question. We have a couple minutes here. If we agree that it's possibly addictive, is that a bad thing when it comes to music?
It's a good thing. It can change your mood. I mean, I've been in a situation where I've, you know, it's been a tough day or whatever, and I've got an 80s playlist. I turn it on and I will be, or, you
I'm
know,
on sunshine. Is that what you're playing?
All right.
Okay. Enough singing.
Enough of that.
Yeah. Is it a healthy addiction? If it's,
well, I mean, so music has been used for therapy in medicine. So and to the point that was made earlier, just right here on the panel. So I think so.
It brings you back to a happy time, a pleasant memory. Helps you with a little introspection, remembering where you were when you heard a certain song and the point you were in your life, and now you're hearing it again today, and you think about where you are today. I think it could be very helpful.
See, I find it interesting that we only have about a minute and a half left, but I find it interesting we're mostly thinking about good music. I'm thinking about having to listen to, like, Friday over and over. And what if good music has a positive effect on my brain, then what about when all that terrible music...
Every time you turn the corner, it was Who Let the Dogs Out.
Right. I mean, is that then having a negative effect on my brain?
I think that it can have a negative effect on your brain. I mean, there are people that regularly listen to music that contains a lot of violence and a lot of negativity, and a lot of those people tend to trend toward violent behavior.
Or at least depressive.
And depressive behavior, yeah.
I can quit listening to music anytime I want.
Oh, you can't. All right, let me put that out to our listeners while Sam lies about his music habits. Give us your thoughts. Do you agree that music can be addictive is the first question. The second question is that such a bad thing? So you know how to reach us. Leave a message at 404-500-9457. You can find us on Twitter. It's at OST Talk. It is Friday. We're hanging out in the break room. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, why the dictionary is suddenly so virally popular, and do we really need any more James Bond movies? That's next. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. We are having coffee and conversation in the break room like we do every Friday. My guests are Sam Burnham of All the Biscuits in Georgia blog, Kathy Lohr, former NPR correspondent, frequent guest, Julianne Thompson, Republican strategist, former press secretary for the Georgia GOP, and Tamika DePriest. She is senior director of communications at Emory University. And we want to say thank you, as we do every week, to Savannah Coffee Roasters. They donate the coffee that we drink and make sure that we actually have good coffee in our green room for our guests. You can find them online at savannahcoffee.com. Okay, so after the election in November, there was a lot of uproar about the spread of fake news.
Yeah, no, the fake news. You know what? Whatever happened to journalistic integrity, okay? We all can agree we got a S-H-I ton of crazy people in this country, right? And crazy people don't need enough fake news to get them going.
Okay, so social media sites like Facebook have been strongly criticized for helping to spread fake news, and now Facebook and Google are taking some steps. But I wonder whose responsibility we think it is in the end. Is it the responsibility of the website where it's posted or the reader who posted it? Should users be held accountable at all when they post fake news?
Yes.
Okay, what would that look like?
Their post should be taken down. Or at least flagged. And I think that's something that Google was trying to do.
Yeah, they are thinking about doing that.
Or looked into that. But I think that there's another problem, which is confirmation bias, which is basically that people believe stuff that they are inclined to believe because this is the way they've always thought. So how do we know what's fake news anymore?
So I think some of these websites that are the purveyors and that do get paid, I mean, some of them get paid some pretty nice money, per month for ad sales, should be held accountable. And it's sort of this era we're in reminds me of another period in time, the early 19th century, which also experienced, you know, sort of this issue of fake news. Mm-hmm. And that's when the tabloids sort of emerged as the answer to understanding and separating sort of factual news from fake news. I don't know what the solution is for this era, but we need one.
Okay. Sam?
I think there's a lot of responsibility that needs to be picked up by the people who are actually reading the news, the consumers themselves. We've got to develop...
That would be like the people that are posting, reposting it.
The people that are reposting it, people that are reading it, we need to use some critical thinking skills. We need to recognize the difference between commentary and news, and we need to start taking these things a lot more seriously and not just believing a story that you want to believe and ignoring a story you don't want to believe, but do a little bit of homework and find out from more than one source, is this true, is this not true?
Sam, people don't like homework. Okay.
I understand that, but if we're going to be adults and we're going to live in a republic, we're going to have to do some homework.
You know, and I think he brings up a really good point, as do you. People don't like homework. People like to get their news in short, concise sound bites. I mean, it's the age of social media. And I think he brings up another good point as well, that we have to understand the difference. It's incumbent upon us to understand the difference between commentary and real news. And with all of the blogs that are out there, with all of, even in our newspapers, all of the political commentary is usually based on somebody's own personal political agenda, and it's not necessarily driven by fact. But ultimately, I'm going to break with the crowd a little bit and say that it is the responsibility of the reader. I can see if the publications are being held accountable for slander, that they would want to get involved in you know, taking them down and things like that. But if they haven't been, then I'm not so sure. And the term fake news is kind of subjective to a point based on your political persuasion. I mean,
well, it's being used subjectively, yeah, but is. I feel like there's facts or there's not facts. I mean,
it's coming out of Washington in a very subjective
yes,
manner.
Yes, absolutely, on all sides.
Yes.
All right, so since we are talking about things that actually can be proven, one of those would usually be dictionary definitions, right? So... oddly enough, one of the voices in politics these days is Merriam-Webster. They are going viral with their tweets and posts.
Veterans of our military will no longer have served, as served is now defined as getting busted on by a wicked dancer. Wicked, of course, no longer meaning evil, but extremely awesome.
Okay. Over the last few weeks, the dictionary, Merriam-Webster, has been simply issuing definitions of confusing or misplaced words that are used by politicians, and their numbers of followers has gone through the roof. What is driving the sudden popularity of the dictionary?
I think it's great because it means that people are paying attention to what politicians are saying, and they are searching and asking questions. So I was looking up, and the most... what's trending this week, according to Mary, is inclement weather, the definition, which is funny.
Well, because a lot of the country is suffering that.
Right. impugn, calamity, and betrayal after this latest...
Because Sally Yates was accused, the acting attorney general was accused of betraying
the administration.
Yeah. Okay.
So interesting that those are the words that came up most often.
Yes. Fascism has been a popular one lately, people looking that up. What do you think, Sam? Why the dictionary?
I think they have a very astute way of approaching popular culture. They're on Twitter. They're on Facebook. They're posting these things. People are seeing them. It's striking a chord with whichever side of an argument they're on. I think they are involved in popular culture more than they're in linguistic superior, the obvious Oxford English Dictionary, which a good traditionalist like myself would much rather prefer the definitions of, but they're playing their game right. They're getting a lot of attention.
They've been working on their social media personality, you know, so this era is not their first rodeo, and they've really created sort of a practice of leveraging hot topics, and so now I think they're at a point in time where they can really really take advantage of that.
A rodeo defined as an exhibition in which cowboys demonstrate their skills. Julianne?
No, I agree with everything that's been said so far. I really don't have a lot to add to that. I think it's very exciting. I think it's very exciting that people are taking this seriously. I think it's great that they're taking advantage of the fact that people are interested in what things actually mean. And they're battling pop culture and Urban Dictionary for the true meaning of words and taking advantage of that. So I think it's great.
You have to be careful consulting the Urban Dictionary because it can be very shocking and upsetting to look things up in there. I don't always recommend it. Okay, so let's go on to a subject that maybe we are going to get some real disagreement on. We might be in store for yet another James Bond movie.
If we refuse to do business with villains, we'd have almost no one to trade with.
This is the world's most precious resource. We need to control as much of it as we can.
Bond, you killed a man in Brigands. You said you weren't motivated by revenge.
Sony Pictures has announced they are planning at least one more installment. Daniel Craig says he doesn't want to be Bond anymore. John Oliver says he would totally be up for the role, but I think he's probably joking. But here's the question.
He would be funny.
He would. Yeah. That would take James Bond in a totally different, that would be more like Mr. Bean. but
very much.
Should the Bond movies keep going? And if you think so, then who should be the next James Bond?
Yes, keep the Bond movies going. And my vote is for Idris Elba. I say that every time this has been a topic.
Yeah, I second that. But it's a dream of this spy superhero combination. And it's just fun. It's great, amusement. So, okay, I love Sean Connery. It's hard. You can't compare. So I'm going to say Robert Downey Jr., except I know he's too old and that'll never happen.
Well, Idris Elba says he's too old as well.
I don't agree with that.
I don't agree with
people
that
are talking about Tom Hiddleston, who played Loki in the Avengers series. Julianne?
No, not him. Not him.
Not Tom Hiddleston.
No, not for Bond. I'm going to agree on Idris Elba, as does Steven Spielberg. He says that he should be the next James Bond. It's time to shake things up a little bit, and I think it would be fun. I mean, he's a good combination of debonair and gruff, and
he looks like he could do all that. Yeah,
absolutely.
Stuff.
He does.
Like,
absolutely.
Physically capable. Sam?
Well, I'm a huge Sean Connery fan. I will say that.
You're like the traditionalist in everything, so let's just assume you're going to go back to the
but
original.
But I have really enjoyed Daniel Craig as Bond. And if he did it again, I'm going to watch it.
He doesn't
want
to.
But if he doesn't want to, and I can't have a Daniel Craig, I'm going to go with Damian Lewis from Band of Brothers and Homeland. He's my pick for that. I think he has the grit and the suave that you have to be Bond, because you got to be able to do the whole tuxedo, but you've also got to be able to fight some guy on top of a moving train, and you got to be able to play both roles. And I think that that we've seen that he can do that in some of his other
roles.
Personally,
I would like to see a woman. There's no reason why a woman can't be a totally athletic and capable spy.
I'm sitting next to the door out.
You know how to reach us. Let us know if you think the Bond franchise should continue, and if so, who should be Bond? We're hanging out with Julianne Thompson, a Republican strategist, Kathy Lohr, former NPR correspondent, Sam Burnham of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia, and Tamika DePriest, Senior Director of Communications at Emory. Okay, let's go to a much more serious topic, but one that I think really has some room for discussion. 17-year-old Kenneth Sutner killed himself in Missouri just days before Christmas. Those closest to him actually blame his manager at the Dairy Queen where he worked. They say she bullied him mercilessly and to the point of suicide. That manager has now been charged with involuntary manslaughter. But I wonder if we think this is a step too far. Can we blame a bully if the victim takes his or her own life?
I think, I may be the only one. I think maybe this is too far. I think not that she didn't do anything wrong. I think the manager should have been fired long ago. And my issue is also the school bullying that continued. Why didn't people step in? You know, there were 20 or more people that testified at this hearing about all the bullying they saw and that this kid experienced, but nobody did anything.
So I should say that the in order to be convicted of involuntary manslaughter, it means that somebody died as a result of your actions and that the defendant knew or should have known their conduct was a threat to the lives of others, What do we think? Sam, do you think this is too far?
I think that would ultimately be up to the jury, of course, in our system. Personally, I don't know that I could go to the point of the criminal liability on it. I would like to know, you know, why didn't Dairy Queen address this, mm-hmm. that particular Dairy Queen? Why does a supervisor behave if you go and read what she was actually doing to this kid?
Yeah, it was awful.
It was terrible.
Why do you let someone manage your store in that manner and treat your employees that way? As far as the other bullying, you know, obviously she wasn't the only one bullying him. If, are you going to drag all the bullies in and under charges and...
But there are bullies that say include encouragement for you people to kill themselves as part of the bullying.
I think there was a lot of fear in this community. It had to be that they were afraid to stand up to this manager, perhaps. Yeah. You know, I don't know.
That's odd.
And there have been bullies that have encouraged people to kill themselves.
Take their
lives,
this
was not one of them. What she did was unrelenting, and it was terrible. And I say she should have been fired. She should have been sued, you know. File a restraining order or, you know, charge her with stalking back when it was happening. But unless she actually pulled the trigger, I think, or told the child to pull the trigger, I think it's going too far to charge her with manslaughter. Absolutely.
It's so complex. I'm thinking about bullying that leads to harassment, that leads to death. And I think that we have to figure out what, I think involuntary manslaughter is hard to connect this case to, but there's so much work we have to do around connecting the dots when we have a young person at that age and how bullying and harassment really impacts them at that phase in their life where they're going through self-identity and trying to figure themselves out. I think it's very sensitive and complex, and I don't know how we deal with it. But it's really, really sad that it was not addressed until it got to someone taking their lives.
And it's very difficult to deal with in the age of social media. I mean, bullying has always been there. But when children can then go and post about someone else on social media or take up a fake account on social media just for the purpose of harassing someone else, I mean, like you said, it's very complex and extremely sad, and it's happened to many people.
Okay, so our last topic is about books. How important do you think it is that people read books?
But my dad said about Trump after the meeting, he, meaning Trump, has not read a book in 20 years.
So the average American has not read a book in the last year either.
Okay, so that is true. That's not entirely true. 25% of Americans have not read a full book within the past year. That's the current statistics. Well, a group of teenagers in Virginia were caught painting swastikas and hate symbols and language on the walls of a historically black school. And the judge ordered them to read books like 12 Years a Slave, The Handmaid's Tale, Lincoln. There was a long list. Do we think a sentencing like that could actually be effective rather than community service, picking up trash?
I thought it was great, and I also thought that it would be helped by also adding some conversation and other activity. I mean, to really see if you can move the needle in terms
of... Oh, so not just reading the book,
Not just reading the book in a vacuum, but some collective dialogue and reflection as part of that process as well to really stimulate growth.
I think the kids have to write reports on these books at least one a month is what I
this
read.
This is all about homework today.
But it's an interesting idea. I don't know if it'll change behavior. I think we'll see. One of the things is their families are supposed to be involved. They're supposed to take a trip to the Holocaust Museum and other places. I mean, one of the kids said they didn't even understand what the meaning of a swastika was. So until now, I don't know.
We have a minute left, Julianne and Sam, you want to split that?
Yeah, I agree with everything that's been said so far. But I do agree that there needs to be some dialogue as well. Not just visiting the Holocaust Museum, which is extremely important
and powerful,
everybody should go, and reading the books, but dialogue as well, because these may be children that you can catch before they actually go on to some sort of real criminal behavior. So, yes.
Yeah, I think that the dialogue and the follow-up, some museum tours, some discussions with people involved on the other side of the issue,
I feel like shouldn't our schools empathy. Be doing that already? Anyhow,
they should be.
We are out.
Takes a village.
That's a whole nother break room. We are out of time. I want to say thank you to all our guests. Julianne Thompson is a Republican strategist, former press secretary for the Georgia GOP. Kathy Lohr, journalist, former NPR correspondent. Sam Burnham, dictates the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. You don't dictate, do you? Tamika DePriest is Senior Director of Communications at Emory University. Of course, you can always give us your thoughts. You know how to reach us on Facebook or on Twitter at OST Talk. For today and the week, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great weekend.